You may think you run your own life, but there's something out there running a lot of it for you. Algorithms. Specifically, learning algorithms. They're in your phone, your computer, your television, every smart gadget you own, and they're shaping a lot of your daily life.
Amazon uses machine learning to recommend books, Netflix to recommend movies, Google to decide what search results they return, Facebook for updates. The stocks in your portfolio are probably traded by learning algorithms. Dating, a third of all marriages today start on the internet, and it's machine learning algorithms that select potential matches for you. So there are children alive today who wouldn't have been born if not for machine learning.
I'm Anne Strange-Amps, and today, on to the best of our knowledge, machines that can program themselves are all around us, and they get smarter every day. And if they seem intelligent now, just wait.
Yeah, so here's one of the things that we're going to have in the future because of machine learning that we don't have today. Home robots. We would all love to have robots that, you know, cook dinner for us and do the dishes and make the beds and whatnot. Here's another one, curing cancer. Why haven't we cured cancer yet? Because cancer is not one disease, it's many. Everybody's cancer is different. So there isn't a single drug that's going to cure cancer. What is going to cure cancer is a learning algorithm that predicts what is the right drug for you based on, you know, your genome, your medical history, the mutations that the tumor has, and so on. This is coming, and it takes the learning algorithms that people are developing in the labs today.
Pedro Domingos is one of the world's top experts in the field of machine learning. In his lab and others around the country, data scientists are racing to come up with the one algorithm to rule them all, the master algorithm. This is the one that will be able to tell a machine how to learn anything. But are we ready for this? Because really, how well do you want your machines to know you?
You know, each company has its own sliver of data about you. But what we're going to see in the future is a single model of all of you, based on all the data that you generate. And that model knows you, you know, very well, better than your best friend probably, and it recommends things for you at every step of your life, you know, like what jobs to get, you know, like where to go to school, people to date, you know, all of those things.
Do you like that idea?
There's a very good thing about this idea, and there's also something a little dangerous, right? So I really like the idea of having a model of me that helps me, you know, make my decisions and do my job every day of my life. I actually think that, you know, within the decade, a model like that is going to be more indispensable than your smartphone. People will be asking, how did we ever live without that? How did we make it through the fog of life and in the information overload and whatnot? So on the one hand, I think it's extremely desirable. On the other hand, it's extremely dangerous. Because if that model of you is under the control of something else, they have far too much power. And the way things are actually shipping out today is that the companies that are most advanced in building this, you know, unified model of you, for example, Google or Apple, that have a lot of data because, you know, it goes through your smartphone or Facebook and whatnot, and they have a conflict of interest. In part, they want to serve you, but they also want to make money. So I think, yes, I want a model of me, but I want the model to be under my control. And I suspect that most people will feel the same way.
So let's back up for a minute and talk about how we got here. You're talking about computers that are no longer being programmed in the old way exclusively by people. We're talking about computers that now can keep learning on their own because they're building new algorithms based on existing data, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, in the first stage of the information age, we had to program computers, right? We had to write down in painstaking detail the algorithms that specify what they're supposed to do. The thing that's exciting about, you know, the second stage of the information, which is the one that's now starting, is that the computers can learn by themselves by generalizing from data.
So what's different about the algorithms today that, for instance, can drive a car, you know, Google's new self-driving car? How is that different from the old algorithms?
Well, you know, when we learn to drive, right, one of the things that we're told is that, well, you can read a book about how to drive, but that's not enough to learn. You have to learn to drive by driving. And as it turns out, it's the same thing for computers and robots. They have to learn by doing. The Google cars, right, they've already driven millions of hours. The car that you may be in hasn't driven millions of hours, but it has the accumulated learning of all those millions of hours.
So are you suggesting that the algorithms that we have right now, the learning algorithms that are driving things like, you know, my Amazon or Netflix recommendations, that those are the equivalent of teenage algorithms that are just learning and they're going to grow up and get a lot better?
Yes. In fact, let me make it even more extreme, right? I think the machine learning algorithms that we have today are not even at the level of a baby. If we knew how to make a learning algorithm that has the same ability to learn as a newborn, that would be amazing. That would be the greatest revolution in history. Now, to be fair, you know, one approach to doing this is literally to emulate the brain, right, with networks of neurons and whatnot. There's other approaches, like, for example, another one is to simulate evolution, right, because evolution, you know, creates a lot of things from experience, and so on.
But so when you talk about a master algorithm, this is what you mean?
Yeah. So what is a master algorithm? A master algorithm is an algorithm that can learn anything from data. Right. The big difference between the learning algorithm and the programmed algorithm is that the programmed algorithm can only do one thing. Right. If you want to play chess, you have to program it to play chess. If you want to drive a car, you have to program it to drive a car. The amazing thing about a learning algorithm is that it doesn't know anything about chess or driving a car or medical diagnosis or whatever. But if you give it different data, it will learn to do different things. Another question is, how far can you take that? And each of these schools of thought has its own approach. Like, for example, as I said, one is to, you know, mimic the brain. Another one is evolution. But what I and a lot of other people believe is that none of these algorithms actually has all the pieces. What we really need is a unified algorithm, a grand unified theory of machine learning, if you will. Like the standard model is the grand unified theory of physics, or, you know, the central dogma is the grand unified theory of biology.
So you're saying what you want to come up with is the one algorithm that knows how to learn. That's all it needs to know, is just how to learn.
Exactly. That's precisely. If you know how to learn, in some sense, you know, that's all that you need.
Hmm. So I take it that some of this is already happening, and that companies like Google and Facebook and Apple are probably already creating the learning algorithms, the learning machines of the future. What are they doing now that, you know, might surprise us?
You're definitely right, right? So these companies are all in a race to see, you know, who gets to the best learner first. They buy startups that do these things. For example, Google a year ago bought this company called DeepMind, whose explicit goal is to, you know, build a brain in a computer. And they paid over $500 million for this company that actually had no products and no customers, just because they thought it would give them an edge in this race. So, you know, what we're going to see from these companies as they compete is we're going to see increasingly powerful learning algorithms that do things that you didn't think were possible before.
Like what?
Again, like, for example, driving a car, right? People used to say, like, oh, driving a car isn't going to happen anytime soon. Like curing cancer, right? We actually now have a sense of how we might get there.
So do you think the right algorithm could pretty much solve every problem we have?
Not quite, for a couple of reasons. One is that some problems cannot be solved. The consensus, you know, for the first decades of AI was that the first things to be automated would be the blue-collar jobs, because those require, you know, less skill. Mm-hmm. And the white-collar jobs would be harder, you know, like a doctor, for example, or a lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. As it turns out, it's not like that. There are a lot of blue-collar jobs that are actually very hard to automate, like construction worker, for example. We will have an automated doctor well before we have a robot that can do construction work.
You know, Pedro, people have been saying for a while that super intelligent machines like the ones you're describing could someday take over the world. The artificial intelligence of the future really isn't going to need humans at all. And even people like, you know, Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates have said this is something worth worrying about. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this has certainly been, you know, in the public mind a lot. You know, it's like it's the Terminator scenario, right? And like Skynet comes and takes it over. I think these fears are overblown. I actually don't know too many AI experts that take this too seriously. The mistake that people are making, and it's a very natural one, is that they are confusing being intelligent with being human. This is natural, right? Because, you know, the only highly intelligent entity that we know is human beings. And also, you know, in Hollywood movies, the AIs and the robots are always humans in disguise. But real AIs are actually very different from human beings. They can be infinitely intelligent, but they don't have a will of their own. They don't have emotions. They don't have consciousness, et cetera, et cetera. So they're intelligent and they're not human. You know, the machines are a tool. We use them for our purposes, and we can design them to just solve the problems that we set them, and then we check the results, and that's all they can ever do. If we are rash enough to make machines whose goal is to take over the world, well, then maybe we'll get what we deserve.
Pedro Domingos, He's a computer scientist at the University of Washington and the author of The Master Algorithm.
Here's something that is true about machine intelligence that's an immediate crisis and question for us. And it's not what people call AI, artificial intelligence, but I call it AppI, app intelligence. And it has to do fundamentally with the abdication of free will.
David Krakauer, president of the Santa Fe Institute, with a dangerous idea.
It is already the case that for many of us, when we make a decision about what book to read or what film to see or what restaurant to eat at, we don't make a reasoned decision based on personal experience, but on the recommendations of an app. So that little bit of free will that we got to exercise in our daily lives has evaporated. Now let's just extrapolate a little bit further forward. Imagine voter app. Well, I have a certain income, I have certain preferences, I have certain ideals. Let me just enter those into my app and it'll tell me who to vote for. Now the reality is, it's amazing we don't already have one, because it's clearly better than what we do now, because for most people you say, well, I love their hairdo, you know, or, you know, I like the way they speak, or they amuse me, or whatever proxy for decision making they employ. So there's voter app. How about eater app? Well, you know, we are busy people. We work long days. I get home, you know, and there's just so many times I can eat Cheerios or a fried egg. Why don't I just enter my state of health? I'm fat, I don't have to, because my phone has already recorded exactly how many steps I've taken today, and it knows better than I do what I should be having for dinner. It also knows my taste profile, and it understands my pre-existing conditions, which it does not want to exacerbate. So there's Eater app, and Reader app, and Listener app. So before long, the domain in which we get to exercise our intelligence will be a point. That's a reality. I'm not technology doom and gloom type. I love the stuff. But I am aware that with all of these increments in capability are coming decrements in humanity. I think the history of humanity is the history of our coevolution with devices and artifacts that make our lives easier. And I think it's now a question for moral philosophy, not for science, to decide how we use them and what it would mean to be enslaved by them, whether we do so willingly or reluctantly. And I genuinely believe that's a philosophical question. The fact of whether machines will get better and better and better, I think, is a foregone conclusion. They will, they have. What do we want to keep for ourselves is a philosophical, existential question.
David Krakauer is an evolutionary theorist and president of the Santa Fe Institute. The things we'll gain from automating more of our lives, I confess they actually sound pretty good to me. A car that will do the driving for me? Robots that will clean the bathroom and do the laundry? Honestly, I would sacrifice a little bit of free will if it meant I would never have to scrub the grout again. But technology writer Nicholas Carr warns that the cost of smarter machines could be dumber humans. Carr is the guy who wrote a blockbuster article a few years ago called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" Now he's worried that the new age of automation could mean that we'll lose basic skills like how to drive or how to read a map. He spells it out in a new book called "The Glass Cage," and Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Nick, how worried are you about automation and how it's affecting our lives?
I'm pretty worried. My worries tend to be a little bit different from the worries that are in the news right now and getting a lot of play. And those worries tend to focus on massive job losses and, you know, huge unemployment as robots kind of take over. It could happen, but my own fears are more about becoming too dependent on computers and robots to the extent that we begin losing our own skills.
Well, let's take one or two examples of this. Automation has become a big thing in medical settings. Doctors use this technology, for instance, during surgery or during diagnosis of trying to figure out what's going on with their patients. What's happening there?
Well, I think you see both good and bad. You know, on the one hand, if you look at surgical robots, which are really just not so much replacing the surgeon as extending the surgeon's ability, you see that surgeons are able to do more in different kinds of surgery. But more interesting to me is the use of electronic medical records, both to collect information about patients and their visits and to do diagnoses. So what we see there is the primary care physician working more and more in concert with software.
So your fear, I presume, is that the expertise of the doctor who has years of often deciphering strange things and making expert diagnoses, that could be lost.
Or it could be diminished, certainly. What we know about skill, and particularly very subtle skills, is that you need to practice them in order to both gain them and keep them strong. And so we might look, in the doctor's office is a very good example, we might look to software or robots, for instance, to make things more efficient. But the cost comes from distancing the practitioner from the actual work. And over time, what you start to get is a diminishment of skill. And then you get a cycle of you know, what economists call de-skilling, because as you begin to lose your skills, then you become even more dependent on the software.
Right. And another one of your test cases is automated flight. Now, we know more and more pilots use automation to fly planes, and statistically, this has made air travel safer, but you also seem to be worried about this.
Yeah, I think aviation is kind of the perfect sort of test case for automation, where you see both the very good effects of being able to hand over some chores to computers, working together, the human pilot in the software. We've seen great advances in airline safety. But more recently, what we've seen is that pilots have handed over so much of the work to autopilot systems and other flight automation systems that really the pilot is only in manual control of the plane for a couple of minutes, usually, for most flights these days. And the evidence shows that in those rare cases when something goes wrong and a disaster happens, it seems to be more and more linked to the loss of pilot skills resulting from overdependency on automation. What happens sometimes is the autopilot fails. It might be you run into some heavy weather or you have a technical difficulty. You know, no technology is flawless. And so when that happens, suddenly the pilots, they have to take command of the plane in a situation that's usually very dangerous, which is why the technology failed. And as a result, you start seeing pilots make mistakes.
Now, can we actually point to specific crashes and basically say, well, it was because the pilots did the wrong thing when the automation failed?
Yes. One of the most tragic recent plane crashes was in 2009 when an Air France Airbus that was flying from Rio de Janeiro to Paris disappeared out of the sky over the Atlantic. And it took a couple of years to find the plane and to lift it out of the ocean. But what the investigators found when they studied the flight data recorder and the voice recorder was that the plane had hit some bad weather. The external sensors that feed airspeed information to the computers had iced over. And of course, once you take that crucial information away from the computers can't fly the plane because they don't have the data necessary. And so the autopilot system shut down, and suddenly the pilots had to take over. And the pilot that was in charge, instead of taking a maneuver necessary to avoid going into a stall, an aerodynamic stall, which essentially required the pilot to descend in order to pick up speed, the pilot pulled back on the stick and raised the nose of the plane, slowed the plane down. The plane did go into a stall and plummeted 30,000 feet or so into the ocean and killed everybody on board.
Now, we've been talking about existing technologies. One that we'll probably see in the near future is self-driving cars. Google already has this in development, and there are a few test cars out there. Do you think we'll be seeing a lot of this in the coming years?
I think we still don't know exactly how much driving computers, real-world driving computers, will be able to take over and when they'll be able to take it over. I think there's some amount of overpromise going on here. Automated cars, robotic cars, are very good in tightly controlled situations where there isn't all that much uncertainty, such as driving on limited access highways, where most of the testing of Google's car and other robotic cars has been done.
I have to say, my gut reaction is trying to navigate a lot of traffic in a busy city to turn that over to the computer sounds like a nightmare.
I would argue we're still quite a long way from being able to do that. I think it's possible that what we'll see is that you'll have, for instance, robotic trucks taking over long-haul trucking. But then you'll have to take over again in certain situations. And of course, in some ways, it's even more dangerous on the road because your margin for error, since cars tend to travel very close together and lanes and roads aren't very wide, your margin for error there is very, very small. You have to kind of take over in a matter of, you know, a couple of seconds if you want to avoid a car crash.
So I'm assuming that the argument on the other side that Google would make is that the computer sensors can see the encroaching car faster than you might be able to recognize it yourself. That actually would make driving safer.
And I think that's right, that if we use automation wisely, then I think we can have automation that helps us drive better.
Well, I mean, the other side of it is a lot of people, including me, like to drive. I don't really want to turn it over to a computer. I mean, maybe not always on, you know, the long haul over a cross-country trip, but normal city driving, yeah, I'd rather do that.
And I think that's a big blind spot, particularly among people in Silicon Valley, the people developing these systems. Most people in studies are pretty clear about this. Most people are like you and are like me. They actually enjoy driving. It's a time when people can be in charge of a complex machine themselves. And there's a certain amount of pleasure in being in control and in maneuvering a vehicle through traffic. And that points to something, a broader kind of reality that people like to do things. We like to struggle with hard challenges. We like to overcome them. We like to develop our expertise.
Right. Well, the great promise of automation, of robots, is it will make our lives easier. The question is, does it also make us happier? Or actually, is it sort of taking away some of the stuff that we really enjoy, but we may not always realize?
I think there's a tension in us ourselves that we think we want our lives to be easier and convenient and to hand over everything to machines. But then when you look at psychological studies of human experience, it turns out that actually developing skills and acting in the world and facing and overcoming challenges is actually a source of great satisfaction and great fulfillment. And if you just make things easy for people, they're not very happy. And it strikes me that we're pushing ourselves, and technologists are pushing us as well, into a world where we're not going to be challenged. That every time we face a challenge, there's going to be a software engineer or a computer company saying, well, let's automate that.
And there are obviously also some pretty big ethical issues that come up. I mean, just to go back to the example of the self-driving car. I mean, if there's an accident, if someone gets killed, who's to blame? Who do you sue? Is it the computer system of the car manufacturer, or is it the person in the car? And then at a far more mundane level, but kind of a fascinating level, I mean, you write about the Roomba, the robot vacuum cleaner that sucks up all the little stuff in its path. I mean, it doesn't make any distinction between the dust bunny or the insect. It doesn't distinguish between life and non-life. And those are the kinds of things we probably think about while we're vacuuming.
Right. Many people might think of the example of as a trivial one that, you know, okay, so we let the Roomba loose it on our carpet and it sucks up a few crickets as well as all the dust and everything. But a lot of people think about things like that. You know, that you see a cricket in front of you or a little insect and you think, do I really want to kill it, or should maybe I make an effort to take it outside? And it tells us something about the new world we're now entering as we create robots that are able to act autonomously in the world. They're going to come up against ethically complex situations. And so the question is, how do we program an ethical sense, a moral sense, into machines? And beyond that, who gets to do that programming? Whose morality is programmed into these robots? Does somehow the robotic car's morality, the way it determines whether it's going to, you know, run over a squirrel or a dog or try to swerve to avoid them? Is that, are we going to be able to reflect the driver's morality somehow? Or is it ultimately going to be the morality of the insurance company or the government or the software programmer? There's no way you can have an autonomous robot acting in the real world without requiring that robot sooner or later to make moral decisions.
That's Nicholas Carr talking with Steve Paulson about his new book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. Coming up, the androids of the 18th century. The Forgotten History of the Automaton. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. A favorite theme for Hollywood movies is the angry, vengeful robot, the beautiful android who turns on her creators. In fact, many of the first robots were women, and they were adored and admired more than 200 years ago. In late 18th century Europe, life-size androids built to look like women dazzled wealthy aristocrats. They wore fashionable gowns. They could look around. They could even play musical instruments. Historian Heidi Voskel tells the story in her book, Androids in the Enlightenment. Raymond Tangekar talked with her.
So Heidi, I gotta say, I was floored when I learned that people were actually creating androids in the 18th century. I mean, why would anyone in that period want to make this human-looking robot?
One reason would be that there was craftsmanship and artisanship around already in the 18th century. Particular furniture making and clock making had been around for quite a while and was slowly approaching some kind of culmination in the middle towards the late 18th century, when the social and the economic system on the European continent was following a court society and an estate society. And what they needed to keep up this ostentatious lifestyle and to show off their political power was what we call spectacles, and they needed those in their households. For example, very sophisticated clocks or furniture, as well as mechanical gadgets or toys inside of this furniture. And we could think of these androids as extensions of the existing commodities that were already produced in these workshops.
So basically, I mean, these were objects that the aristocracy would show off to others. Can you describe the woman who plays the harpsichord?
Sure. The woman who plays the harpsichord, she was made in Switzerland in the late 1760s and early 1770s. She's about a bit more than 4 feet high, sits on a stool in front of a harpsichord. So she's at eye level with a seated spectator. There are two mechanisms inside of her. One mechanism moves her hands above the keyboard horizontally to the left and the right, and the other mechanism moves her fingers up and down as soon as her hand is on the right position above the keyboard. There's a couple of other important mechanisms inside of her. One makes her eyes move as if she was following the motion of her hands above the keyboard. And the other very important mechanism is inside her chest, makes her chest move up and down as if she was breathing. So when you sit in front of this automaton, first she just starts looking at you, then she starts breathing, and then she starts playing the harpsichord. That is how the mechanism is programmed, as it were.
I've seen videos of this, and I gotta say, like, it's a little creepy, right? She's looking at you, and she's breathing. She's really realistic and lifelike.
Yeah, yeah. The understanding that it's creepy, or often we say uncanny, that is language that was developed a little later in the 19th century, beginning with Sigmund Freud. He read a piece of fiction, a literary story by E.T.A. Hoffmann about an automaton that was very different from the one that I saw. But then Freud built the notion of the uncanny into his theory of psychoanalysis and into the theory of the return of the repressed. And that became so popular and it stuck so well that to this day, we like to use terms like creepy or uncanny to describe androids.
So who actually created this android?
So this was a father and son team of artisans. They were both clockmakers in the mid to the late 18th century in Switzerland, in the far western part of Switzerland near the French border. We know that they were both very gifted clockmakers, and the father, Pierre, was in a position to send his son, Henri-Louis, to university in Nancy in France. And when his son returned, that's when they started the production of this harpsichord playing woman automaton. And he studied music, drawing, and mechanics, his son. So he probably brought some skills with him back from university to help his father build this automaton.
I'm kind of surprised to hear that it was actually a clockmaker that created this. I mean, based on how intricate and complicated it is, I would think that, you know, like a leading engineer or something would have been the inventor of this.
Yeah. Engineers didn't really come into being as a profession until 100 years later. So the clockmakers at the time was actually the artisans and the furniture makers and the carpenters and the piano makers. They were the ones who knew most about how to build intricate mechanisms.
Hmm. Well, and it turns out that this harpsichord playing android, it still exists, right? It's in a museum in Switzerland.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
You know, I saw a video of it and it's just stunning. It's incredible. And I'm saying this in 2015. I can only imagine how much of a spectacle it must have caused back in the 18th century.
This was a very specific moment for such sophisticated mechanical work. If you want to measure the sophistication of mechanical precision and ingenuity, that sort of peaked right around that time because there was a market for these things that could be sold. Once the Industrial Revolution kicked in, commodities were made smaller, simpler, and much cheaper for a much broader audience of people to buy them. I like to say that they were in competition with other spectacles. So if you and I had been members at the time of a very thin crust of aristocracy, we would be wandering around and hanging out with other aristocratic families. And at their houses before dinner, we would probably be exposed to their toys and their mechanical toys. So I want to say that we would be used to watching spectacular things.
Huh. So maybe in other words, it's you're basically flaunting your might by showing off these ostentatious objects.
Yeah. Yeah. We are at a time, if I can quickly add this, where these aristocratic lifestyles and some middle-class lifestyles already mesh with each other and start mixing, and then the whole thing breaks down with the French Revolution in 1789. So we are looking at a period right on the cusp of the end of this court society.
Well, I want to go back to this harpsichord playing android just for a second. And earlier you mentioned that, you know, its eyes, it appears that it's looking at you, it appears to be breathing.
Mm-hmm.
It also kind of moves in a very specific and interesting way. It's almost like emoting and performing.
Yes.
Why was that? Why was it important for the creator to actually include that?
So that goes back to the politics of the 18th century. What we see is middle classes, or we call them bourgeois classes, developing techniques and practices of hanging out with each other, of socializing. And among those practices was conversation, of letter writing, of friendship. And there was an element, an emotional element in there. There was an idea of sentimental activity. So the entire shift from a court society to a civil society happened, among other things, through a culture of sentiments. And this, it's almost a cliche that a young woman would be playing the piano. And that altogether was considered to be the practice and the construction of a virtuous, sentimental member of a civil society.
Huh. So you're basically saying that this isn't simply like a cool robot that plays music. It's actually demonstrating in a way what it means to be like a virtuous person or...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, you're saying people at the time were actually kind of examining what it means to be human by looking at a robot.
Yes, exactly. And maybe you can wonder if we are doing the exact same thing right nowadays. They were trying to figure out what humans are, and the specific political situation made them ask very specific questions about what it means to be human in specific political and cultural ways.
Heidi Voskel is a historian of technology at the University of Pennsylvania. She talked with Raymond Tungekar about her book, Androids in the Enlightenment. And if you want to see some of those 18th century robots, visit our website. It's at ttbook.org. So this hour, we're wondering how much of our world can actually be automated. In other words, where do you draw the line between human and machine? Well, take creativity. Could a computer ever write a novel? Not just a crappy formulaic novel, a great one, a work of art. The pioneering software developer Stephen Wolfram thinks a lot about this kind of thing, and he told Steve Paulson that machines can already do much more than we realize. It's just a matter of how they're programmed.
Just left to its own devices, the machine doesn't know what to do. It has to be told, your goal is to whatever, you know, to make the most money for me today, or to provide me the best possible recommendation about what food I should eat, or, you know, whatever else it is.
Well, I guess, I mean, it raises the question of how much of our lives can become computational. For instance, when we start talking about values or what wisdom might be, or deciding what's good or evil, or when you get into aesthetic questions about creativity, about beauty, does computation have much or anything to say about these things?
Sure. I mean, if you say, this is something I consider beautiful, okay, show me 1,000 things you consider beautiful, 1,000 things you consider not beautiful. It's actually really pretty easy at this point to use machine learning to be able to say, okay, given a new thing that you're going to be shown, will you find that beautiful or not? It'll be able to predict that quite accurately. Then if you say, well, can you generate something that I would find beautiful? The answer is absolutely yes.
Do you think a computer will ever be able to write a good novel?
That's an interesting one. The answer is surely yes. Okay, it'll be soap operas first, probably.
There are going to be formulas there that you follow.
Right. Let's say you're trying to write a novel. The goal is make something that is engaging in this or that way to humans. So then the question is, how do you achieve that? How do you create something of that type? Well, one thing you can do is you just start searching in the space of possible programs, possible kind of rules for how you construct things. You search in that space, and maybe you search a billion possible sets of rules. And out of that billion possible sets of rules, you find one that's kind of interesting. And people will say, oh, that's interesting. That's very creative. That's very original.
Well, let me up the ante then. Do you think somewhere in the future a computer will ever be able to write a great novel? You know, a Ulysses-type novel, a Lolita, something that just would blow people away.
Well, I think the answer is definitely yes. So, for example, in the visual domain, okay, from the kinds of things that it's been possible to get computers to produce in terms of visual effects, whether they're the fractal picture, the cellular automaton picture, the movie special effect, and so on, some of these things are pretty good. Now, in terms of the technical sort of thing of natural language generation, you know, that's something that is progressing a little less quickly than some of these other things, but we'll gradually get there. And the thing that is remarkable about sort of things mined from the computational universe is they're very unexpected often. And maybe the computer will search through a trillion programs and it'll come out and say, okay, here's a program that achieves the objectives that you're trying to achieve. You look at that program, it's quite a humbling business because you look at the program and you'll often say, I don't understand how that works. That'll be the first, that's the first response. Then the next response is often, that's really pretty clever. Now, what does that mean? It means out in this computational universe, our machines mind something that it's something surprising to us. It's something often very elegant, in fact, in the way that it works. But it's something that didn't come from us constructing it. It's something that was just sort of out there in the computational universe of possibilities.
Well, now, I mean, the question that we're kind of dancing around here is there anything that's sort of uniquely human that computers can't do? And, you know, I mean, I think creativity would seem to be one logical thing. The subjective experience of what we feel might seem like something. But I guess the question is, are those ultimately just computational in the end?
You know, as I'm saying, creativity is not the one to aim for. I mean, the thing that really surprises me, for example, with our music generation website, is that I thought people would say, well, the humans have to kind of put in the creative spark and then maybe the computer can dress up the music. But what instead I've heard from people, from composers and so on, is that website is really pretty interesting to get an initial creative idea from. And then we'll dress it up and understand it and so on. So I think if you ask, you know, what is there that is quintessentially human, the answer is there's all of our history and all of the sort of the culture and civilization that we've built up.
But it's not actually, it's not looking in an individual's brain and saying, you know, there's something here that is just totally distinct from what a computer can do.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that the great thing that we have is everything that we've achieved in our civilization, often represented by sort of the things that we represent with language and can sort of explain to the next generation and so on. You know, when you say, is there something about the brain, is there some magic feature of the brain that is just so totally different from every other system in nature and so on? I don't think so. You know, but I think the thing that is still, to me, the remarkable thing is still sort of everything that we've built up. I mean, not what an individual human learns, but the complete corpus of stuff that our civilization has produced, all that knowledge that has been passed down from generation to generation and so on. I mean, that I think is, you know, that is the impressive, uniquely human thing that we have.
Stephen Wolfram is a software developer and the CEO of Wolfram Research. He talked with Steve Paulson. So what do you think about the idea of computers making art? Share your thoughts on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up, are you old enough to remember life before computers? Novelist Garth Hallberg paints a sweeping portrait of New York City in the last years before the internet changed everything. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. City on Fire by Garth Risk Hallberg is one of those debut novels that takes critics and readers by the neck. It's a sweeping 900-page story about New York City in the mid-70s. Chronicles everything from the punk music scene to the rise of Wall Street's runaway hedge funds. In some ways, it's an old-fashioned novel, something like Dickens or Trollope. It's got dozens of characters, a dissection of socioeconomic class, which is all a bit surprising considering Garth Hallberg's own background.
I grew up in a town in eastern North Carolina. If you went past my house, there was a field. And if you went past that field, there was another field. And beyond that was a third field. And it was just sort of fields all the way. And for me, as a little kid, I had some kind of feeling of being out of place or longing for, you know, larger and more crowded horizons. And the way that I found them was in reading books. And the books that I loved as a little kid, even then, were the kind of world-building books. There was Middle Earth and there was Narnia, but there was also New York City and Harriet the Spy and Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing by Judy Blume and Eloise and From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Bazley Frankweiler. And that fantasy world to me was every bit as bewitching as Middle Earth, except it was real.
Well, you're talking about the original romance of New York, because I could add to that. I mean, I know exactly what you mean. I'm immediately thinking of Stuart Little and the cricket
Stuart
in
Little.
Times Square. That's, I think, of sort of the early romantic version of New York in the 60s, the center of everything, bustling and in some ways not yet unsafe.
The kind of glittering post-war New York, as a, you know, nerdy book kid, I just thought, wow, that must be the best place on earth.
Well, you're also kind of making the point that New York is a story. And, you know, what would New York be without the writers who have written it over the years?
You know, there's a line in the book about it being many stories. What is it? There's 8 million stories in the Naked City.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was a teenager, you know, I found another kind of avenue for dreaming of, you know, different possibilities. And that was punk music. The punk scene that I was sort of on the fringes of was in Washington, D.C., which was about 5 hours away. This was the mid-90s. But you know, to be around that music at all is to start to sort of excavate this history that goes back to the mid-70s in New York. You know, and the city was sort of crumbling and unsafe and edgy and dangerous and impossible and crazy, but also somehow open and radically tolerant and fertile with possibilities for people who wanted to make things. And then after the attacks of 2001, you know, by that point, I was very close to, you know, actually finally moving to New York and trying to start a life scraping to make art. And that moment of the city being thrown back into a state of disaster and the ways that it brought out the best and the worst in people, I just was thinking about the coexistence of danger and risk with freedom and possibility. And somehow a meaningful life has to be lived between those two poles, and that this is what adulthood is.
So let's talk about a couple of the characters in your novel. I'm thinking, since we've been talking about your teenage self, there are a couple of teenagers, Sam, short for Samantha, and Charlie. And she's like the wild girl, the dropout, the punk fan. She's writing an early zine. And he's sort of like the dork sidekick, the awkward asthmatic kid who's got a crush on her, follows her around punk clubs with his inhaler in his hand. She's a writer. An observer, is she a stand-in for you?
I think yes. When I think about Sam, she's the part of me that, you know, has to be making things, has to be expressing herself, and yet is feeling really stymied. And on the surface, she has these kinds of self-destructive tendencies that it makes her seem very cool. But people are confused about her because underneath, she doesn't want to be destroying things. She wants to be creating things.
And they find their new selves through music. I was going to ask if you'd read a little bit.
Sure.
Sam has taken Charlie into a record store. I'm not sure he's ever even heard any punk music. And this is his kind of initiation.
There was a turntable near the register where you could listen to records pre-purchase. Sam placed the headphones on Charlie's head, a weirdly intimate gesture, and queued up the B-side and watched his face while he listened. At first, he thought there was something wrong with the headphones. The music was a distant tempest of revved-up drums and guitars. But when the instruments locked up and the chanting started, he understood it was a style. Amateur, noisy, aggressive. It was anger heated to the boiling point, where it became a sort of joy. When he looked up, Sam's mouth was moving. He took off the headphones. "What?" he said. "Amazing, right?" she said. "It is amazing, but I don't have any money." "I'll buy it for you," she said. "I can't let you do that." "Sure you can," she said. "Anyway, I owe you." "For what?" "You said you have a car, right? You're driving me home."
So that's the beginning. And then pretty soon, they're hanging out in the village all the time. And they just kind of goof around. They shoplift from drugstores. They graffiti song lyrics on walls. This isn't necessarily a world that you were part of. How did you research it to bring it to life?
Well, I had experiences as a teenager in the village with interestingly wild girls, you know, goofing off and getting into sort of misdemeanor level trouble and experiencing that as a kind of thrilling liberation. And so I was carrying that around somewhere. You know, my wife, I don't even know if I should say this, but I suppose the statute of limitations has expired. You know, my wife got in trouble for tagging things, you know, when she was a teenager with her Sharpie marker. My friends were in bands. You know, I was in a band very briefly.
You also created a band, probably more than one in this book. But just since we're talking about bands, I'm curious, what band do you think the one you created in the book, Ex Post Facto, what do you think it sounds like?
I had in mind some of the sound of the Talking Heads, because punk actually, you know, 70s punk was a very musically kind of ecumenical movement. So the Talking Heads thing, where it has this kind of like funky undertow and then this very angular guitar and sometimes a slightly shouty vocal quality was something I had in mind.
Okay, I have to ask, because you titled the book City on Fire. Are you thinking of burning down the house?
No, actually, I not intentionally. I might have been thinking, there's a Sondheim song in Sweeney Todd called City on Fire, right? Yeah. I just thought the title epitomized this interesting coexistence of destruction, like the city's on fire. And in the mid-70s, you know, sections of the city were literally smoldering from this kind of arson that mm-hmm. went on serially, but also city on fire, like on fire with excitement, with life, with passion. And then there's a kind of a interesting parallel to me in the world of finance and, you know, high finance and real estate development, which is also in the book. And there, too, you have characters who see what they're doing as a way to build new and lasting institutions and structures, and people who see what they're doing as a way to get what they want quickly and expediently, and who cares who gets run over in the process.
Right. And so you're also kind of asking the question, who profits when cities burn, literally, when, you know, yeah. whole neighborhoods are taken down by arson, which is the point at which your story moves uptown to this world of high finance and real estate development and investment banking. And I was thinking, oh, you're exploring the other meaning of burned, as in cheated.
Oh, I like that. That had not occurred to me, but I'm like, yes, that sounds exactly right. I mean, in macroeconomics and finance, they talk about capitalism as creative destruction. And so I was watching this kind of thing ripple through the economy that felt and was incredibly destructive. And yet all of that destruction also cleared the way for great accumulations of wealth. And that's one of the things that's going on, you know, in the 70s is really the burning of the city is part of what laid the stage for the New York that you see in, you know, Bright Lights, Big City, you know, the 80s, the kind of glitz and glamour, Nouvelle Cuisine, you know, Bret Easton Ellis novels and things like that. And that they're somehow related in the way that creation and destruction are related in private life as well.
Garth Risk-Hallberg, his 900-page debut novel is called City on Fire. That's it for our show today, but there's always more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you download your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review. That helps other people find the show. Plus, we really like knowing what you think. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director is Joe Hartke, and today's audio engineer is Steve Gotcher. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.